I read a story today on The Hill, and the headline was Trump joke hint wants to hang all gay people, New Yorker reports. Now, as horrible as that headline is, and as true as it probably is, unfortunately, I actually want to talk about another small detail in that story. Listen to this. Listen to this quote from The Hill, from this article today, about Trump and Pence. It says, Trump jabbed at Pence after a legal scholar told the pair that if the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, many states would probably legalize abortion. You see, Trump reportedly said to Pence, you've wasted all this time and energy on it, and it's not going to end abortion anyway. So, Donald Trump was a golden calf for the old pro-life movement and pro-life conservatives, in my opinion. He was endorsed by a troubling number of pro-life organizations or organizations that claim to be pro-life. A Catholic priest, Father Frank Pavone, who heads up Priests for Life, went as far as to put the corpse of a dead child on the altar to make the case for Donald Trump. It was a fetus, but it was absolutely the corpse of a dead child on an altar to make the case for Donald Trump, which is horrible enough in itself. But there were a ton of us, Rebecca and myself, a lot of us in the new pro-life movement, mm-hmm. and even those that aren't involved with it, who spent the entire year last year warning other pro-lifers about this. We tried to tell you that Donald Trump didn't care about abortion and that he didn't care about you, and yet you swore up and down that Donald Trump was the only choice because he was going to be the one that stopped abortion. And if Hillary Clinton got into office and it was going to be nothing but a big, giant baby slaughter, and Donald Trump was the only one who was going to do anything about it. Yet, here we are, 269 long-ass days into the Trump presidency, with a Republican majority in both chambers of Congress and a freshly appointed conservative judge on the Supreme Court, and abortion is still legal, and Trump is making jokes about it. This is episode 4 of the Co-op, yep. The official podcast of the pro-life movement. I am your co-host, Matt Tyson, along with Rebecca Bratton Weiss. Rebecca, I want to hear your thoughts about the story from The Hill. What do you think?
Well, I've been saying each time one of these items comes out, you know, I wish I could say I was surprised.
Right.
But I'm not. I'm not surprised at all. And like you said, we... in fact, the new pro-life movement almost kind of exists because of the rise of Trump and the fact that so many of the outspoken, supposedly pro-life people were kind of hitching the pro-life star to his wagon of infamy. And so we said, you know, this isn't going to do us any good at all. And I would... all along, I've kind of had two thoughts in mind. The first being... it's glaringly obvious to anyone who just uses common sense that Trump does not give one hot damn about unborn lives.
Mm-mm.
There's no evidence ever that in his entire life that he has. Everything he's done has been to kind of further an anti-life culture. And there's no sign of him having a conversion either. It was like... I don't think he's a smart man, but he has a certain low cunning, and with his low cunning, he detected that if he came into certain circles and made a set of kind of pro-life noises, people would jump and cheer and clap. But let's say even if this weren't the case, even if that story hadn't come out, and even if we weren't saying over and over again, I told you so, he doesn't care about abortion. And, I mean, I don't know, Matthew, like, we shouldn't be smug, but... it's kind of all we have left.
I don't
we're losing our health insurance. So.
Yeah, I know. I'm terrified about that because and for no good reason. And by the way, that's not pro-life either, if I can just say that. To go in and just maliciously say, you know what, I don't like what the black guy did, so I'm just going to stop paying the subsidies that help millions and millions and millions of people not die, that help millions and millions and millions of babies get prenatal, or mothers get prenatal care and postnatal care, and help millions and millions of babies, you know, survive and be able to go to the doctor and get their vaccines and get all their shots. Like, how, I want to stop being surprised about it. I want to stop being surprised that anyone in the pro-life movement would think that Donald Trump is even a little bit pro-life. I want to stop, but I just don't know what it is. Maybe I'm too optimistic. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I believe too much in the idea that God made people good, or that at least his creation is good.
Maybe I should have been
a Puritan, you know? Like, I get it. I get where they're coming from when I think about it now, that they're just, everything sucks. Like, I get kind of sympathize with the Puritan. I don't know, part of me wants to wonder if it if it has anything to do with them being in denial still, you know, every little chance they get. Like, he apparently ended the whole contraceptive mandate thing the other day, which I don't.
Right.
I don't consider that even a little bit of a pro-life win, and yet a lot of pro-life people and supporters and organizations cheered that, and it's like, he's over here taking health care away from children. He's never, like you said, Rebecca, he's never showed any kind of evidence that he's actually pro-life or that he cares, or any kind of conversion, and so it's like you're clinging on to the most minor thing. You have all this evidence to the contrary, and yet he goes and he says, oh, I'm just going to make it so that, you know, health insurance providers don't have to provide contraception if they don't want to, and that's your big win, really? Like, that's sad. It's sad. And so I don't know. I don't think it's so much gloating, but part of me feels like, you know, maybe it's we have to take every opportunity we can to point out and say, even if it's not gloating, to say, look, we told you that this was going to happen, and it happened. Stop shitting yourself and just accept the fact that this was a bad idea, a bad choice. And for the love of God, just, if you just get on board and make up for your mistake. Because Trump is too dangerous. He's too, like you said, he's not smart, and I think that's the most dangerous thing about him.
It's scary, But, I mean, there's nothing wrong with saying, I made a bad decision. You know, I can sit here and admit shamefacedly that 20 years ago I adhered to all kinds of what were essentially kind of eugenic arguments about the survival of the fittest, and I'm glad that there was not social networking back in those days, so my stupid thoughts were not broadcast wildly. But you know, we've all made dumb decisions, and if your dumb decision was thinking that Trump was pro-life, then, you know, it's not too late to recant. Join the resistance. We want to have you. So, but something that also occurred to me was that even if in some bizarre kind of looking glass universe, Trump really had decided that abortion was truly super bad, I still wouldn't want to have him as our leader, because everything else he stands for is so anti-life.
Absolutely.
So no, he's not actually concerned about abortion. But if he were, he's doing it in the context of a view of abortion that really seems to be not so much about saving life and more about just kind of trampling on women.
Absolutely.
And it just exacerbates this idea that people have had that the pro-life movement is misogynist and trying to repress women's rights. And people keep saying, no, no, we care about women. We care about women. And yet actions speak louder than words. And
absolutely,
if your action is supporting Trump, then I don't think people are going to believe that you care about women so much anymore.
Absolutely.
You know, maybe initially, but at this point, no.
No, but I would say, too, that, you know, as far as, like, other Catholic organizations that were really happy about the contraceptive mandate, I have a really hard time seeing that as a pro-life win. Maybe you could see it as like a culture war win, or maybe like a, even if you really wanted to stretch it around, which, you know, everybody's making it a religious freedom win. I think that's a little weak, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll talk about that one day. But There's a lot of data out there that you can say contraception either makes abortions increase or makes it decrease. I've seen it argued on both sides. You know, the idea is that if you have contraception, a lot of women are less likely to get pregnant, and therefore women who don't want to be pregnant or who might find themselves in a crisis pregnancy don't find themselves in a crisis pregnancy because of contraception, and therefore they don't get an abortion. But also the same could be said for, I've seen it reported too, that it increases the likelihood that someone's going to get an abortion, because if a lot of women are on contraception and they do get pregnant, then they're much more likely to have an abortion in the first place, because they don't want to, they didn't want to have a baby in the first place. So, and of course, I think all that's nuanced, and there's not really a good way to come down black or white on either side. Mm-hmm. But I will say that there is something to be said, I think, and let's kind of get out of the bounds of Catholic world here. We're going to get back to what we talked about a little bit last week through this, but get outside of Catholic world, get outside of catechism, yes, a little bit, and think about society as a whole, and think about women as a whole, and understand that, you know, you're not going to be able to stop people from having sex. We've never been able to do that. It's never worked. And so for a lot of women, a lot of sexually active women, contraception is just realistically something that is standing in between them and a crisis pregnancy. And yes, you can say, well, they shouldn't be having sex in the first place if they're worried about it. Well, good luck with that. Again, we at the New Pro-Life Movement believe in being realistic when it comes to addressing these issues. To turn around and say, hey, we're going to cut that off for you, I can understand if you're like a libertarian or a hardcore small government Republican, you know, and you think that, you know, the insurance shouldn't have to provide your birth control. But again, the point is that for a lot of women, it is something that's standing between them and a crisis pregnancy. And so even if you don't agree with contraceptive use, it's not really something that it's not a battle. It's not a fight I would consider picking. You know what I mean? It's like, it doesn't seem like it's worth it to say, we're the pro-life movement and you shouldn't have contraception. Like, that to me, in some way, that seems a little counterintuitive.
Yeah. And it really, you know, when women are already afraid, if a woman doesn't recognize the humanity and the dignity of the unborn child, and she's looking at abortion as a way out, and we're saying, well, you know, no, not an option, because dignity of life and all that, and she's thinking, okay, well, I'll just have to use more contraception, and we're like, well, no, actually, we're not going to let you have that either, and yeah, just in case you're wondering, maybe we'll take your health insurance away, but we really respect women a lot. You guys are great.
Great pro-life win, guys.
But yeah, it's not good job, y'all. It's not a justice issue. It's not an issue where, like with the civil rights movement or with the pro-life movement, where an injustice is being done and people are just blindly out there fomenting it and we need to stop them. It's not like that at all. It's much more nuanced. And when we talk about people who are using contraception, you might think, oh, we have some wild party girl over in college, these crazed feminists, three partners a night. I'm actually talking about like Protestant couples, church-going Protestant couples, Jewish families, people who are really active in supporting their communities, educating their children in morality. These are people who, you know, you might have play group with, you might go to Bible study with, and if you're going to try and tell me that they're suffering from a blindness of conscience on the same level as slaveholders, and we just need to make them alert to this terrible evil that they're doing by removing from them the material means of doing it, I just don't see that happening. That's not realistic. Mm-hmm. Try and write a story about that and see if anyone believes it at all.
Absolutely.
No. So, yeah, not what I would consider to be a life issue. It shouldn't be connected with the pro-life movement in the direct way that it is.
Not at all. And I do want to talk a little bit more about contraception and NFP. We talked about that last week a good bit.
Yes.
We talked about the frustrations that a lot of Catholics are facing regarding it. Rebecca and I talked a lot about our desire, not necessarily for an absolute change. And I'm going to talk about this a little bit today. I want to talk very carefully about the words change and the words development, because that's something that's come to light recently that I want to really kind of get into. But we didn't talk so much about a change in teaching, but a desire for more open dialogue between the laity and then the laity and the magisterium about these issues. And then a desire for a little bit more trust in the conscience of each individual Catholic. And we're going to explore that a little bit more And for me, and specifically in the context of how this issue can cloud your faith, and I mean on both sides of the coin. And Becca, I really want to get your thoughts on this too, because I think this is going to be an interesting discussion. We've talked about it a little bit this week, kind of preparing for the show. But for a lot, and again, two sides of the coin here, right? So I think for a lot of people, and I've run into it in Facebook and FP groups, and being involved in Catholic blogging world and Catholic public life, and you know, and if for a lot of people, NFP is or has become and absolutely continues to be an idol for many people. It's
absolutely
something that they are idolizing. And I read recently on Facebook not so long ago a comment by a Catholic writer who has a really strong following on Facebook and online, and is a big proponent of NFP. And I understand, you know, I'm sure there's nuance to this comment, and that's fine. But it, taken at face value, she said that she has an easier time believing the church's teaching on contraception than she does the church's teaching on the Eucharist. She said she finds it easier to believe that the church is right about contraception than the church is about the Eucharist. And again, taking it face value, I think that is a really good example of how NFP is being analyzed. It's because we, I think a lot of us, or a lot of those on that side of the coin, have elevated the whole debate and the concept and the teaching on contraception to that of a sacrament. And it's not a sacrament. And I understand it's an important part of church teaching. I understand there's a lot of theology that went into this, but it's not a sacrament. And I think that it for a lot of people is becoming so much about their faith. And I think for people on the other side of the coin, the couples who are, because Rebecca, you mentioned Protestant couples and Jewish couples, but we also need Catholic couples. There are a lot of Catholic couples out there that have decided,
so
you
many.
Know what? Forget it. I can't do this. We've got to do something. NFP isn't working. We've got to do something. But for those couples that are struggling tremendously for whatever reason, in their marriage, because of this teaching and who are like, you know, we talked about last time are literally suffering who cannot get pregnant for whatever grave or serious or you know, reason that they've come up with. And
really serious reasons. Yeah.
Yes. Life or death serious reasons. Reasons, like if for many of them, I think that this struggle and then this reaction that they're being met with from these people who have idolized NFP is that this teaching is overshadowing everything else for them about the faith. They lose sight of the rest, just how rich and how much more there is to the Catholic faith than just issues about sex and contraception, and I think that it's hurting a lot of people, and it's hurting their faith. And I'll say that I didn't join the church because of her teachings on sex and contraception. I joined it because it's the only religion where you can have like an actual literal encounter with Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I was thinking in a very parallel way that, you know, what attracts me to the faith is not a set of rules, which are actually fairly derivative, because we're not looking at core dogma here. We're not looking at these central tenets of revelation in which it's like, boom, humanity, the divine encounter, everything transformed and changed. We're looking instead at a series of recognitions that we've had to kind of unravel, and we've had to try and understand, well, if this is the case, then how should we act in this case? And so, you know, a lot of the teachings on sexuality are like that. And that's why a lot of them are actually fairly recent. You know, Humanae Vitae was not around for most of the Catholic tradition, but the sacraments were.
Right.
Even if they weren't defined yet, they were present and they were understood. And what bothers me is this bizarre kind of, I guess I'll call it a form of nihilism that I'm seeing with people not only embracing suffering as an act of heroic virtue for the sake of a higher good, but approaching suffering as an end in itself.
Mm-hmm.
And and saying suffering is good. And I just want to say, no, it's not. Suffering is objectively evil. That's why there won't be any in heaven, and that's why you're not allowed to torture people. In fact, you're not even allowed to hit your brother and sister, as I have to tell my children. Mm. You know, causing someone to suffer is to cause objective evil to happen to them. Therefore, suffering is evil. Therefore, if a person is suffering in marriage, that is, in fact, a privation of a do-good. That is not some kind of, oh, well, that's the way it's meant to be. This is the beautiful cross of marriage. Suffering is not beautiful, and the attempt to portray it as such, you follow that through, and you're going to end up actually in the realm of incredibly perverse sex crimes.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to end up in the realm of those who think that it's wonderful to cause sexual suffering to others, and that it's beautiful, and that others are not, just haven't been inducted into their secret sex cults. So yes, sex cult is actually what comes to mind, because I didn't sign on for a sex cult. I signed on for Jesus.
Exactly.
But if I were looking for a sex cult, I would find a more fun one, because this one isn't fun.
Like that, Eyes Wide Shut.
You get have a whole bunch of it. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be the most bland, vanilla sex cult ever.
Yeah.
And so I understand why it happens, because when you find that suffering is inevitable, then you do have to kind of come up with a way of giving meaning to it. And I think that that can be beautiful and sacramental in itself in a way, but you have to remember that it's still not the suffering that is good. It's your capacity through God to kind of transform that experience. So what I keep encountering is all these people saying that we're not allowed to complain about suffering. I don't know. What's the deal with that?
I don't know. And I'll say this. Not everyone is meant to be a martyr, and I think too many of us have a martyr complex.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not saying that people who adhere to the church teaching on contraception are trying to be, you know, are trying to be martyrs. Or so there's a lot of people that adhere to the church teaching of contraception that aren't suffering, and great.
Right.
Great for you. If NFP works for you, if your marriage is happy, if everything is working out for you with NFP, then we're not talking to you. And honest to God, just please keep doing what you're doing and be a great witness for Christ. But for the love of God, leave the people who aren't as happy as you alone. Do not rub it in their face about, you know, oh, well, it's working so wonderful for me and blah. And I used to be like that just a couple years ago. You got to understand, I'm a bit, I've only been Catholic, you know, for half a decade. And so my early days, which was only just a couple years ago, I was, you know, I did that a little bit. I wrote this hardcore anti-contraception stuff in some of my early days, and I go back and I look at that stuff now, and I don't take it down, because, you know, I personally think it's just one of those things. It's a good reminder, but it's one of those things that, looking back on that and looking the way that other people have approached them, it does more harm than good. It does a lot more harm than good to rub your mm-hmm. perfect Catholic NFP life in other people's faces, because what that's going to do is it's going to make those people feel like that they're not good enough, and it's going to make them feel like that they're not worthy enough, and they're not going to come to Mass, and they're not going to go to confession, and they're not going to come and take the Eucharist, and they're not going to they're not going to have their children baptized, and they're going to fall out of the faith. I think I really like a lot of what Pope Francis says about the church being a field hospital. And I'm not at all saying that people who are contracepting are just absolutely 100% need to go to confession right now. Sorry, Michael Voris and everyone else who disagrees with that. I'm sorry. But I think that there's people out there that are legitimately suffering, that made a decision between themselves and God. And I don't know the answer, but I'm not going to sit there and tell them that they're in this some grave state of moral sin. I'm just not going to do it. But the point is that when you take someone who is suffering, who is struggling with church teaching in some respect, and then you essentially gloat your how wonderful things are going for you in front of them, or you don't take them seriously, you're not helping them. You're not admonishing the sinner. You're not helping them see through it. What you're doing is you're pushing them away. People like Michael Voris don't convert people. There's that one weirdo out there every once in a while that I think, you know, got... But Michael Kors doesn't convert people. And I'll tell you right now, people like Michael Kors have no plan to convert people, no matter what he says. And I'm not trying to get off on a Michael Kors rant. It's just all he ever talks about is how sex is bad and how it's bad for you to have sex. And this, of course, this whole conversation plays into it. But yeah, there, and so I will say this too. I want to talk about this as well. Again, it's not so much that we believe that the church is going to or should necessarily change its teaching, but I think that there is going to be and there should be more development on this subject. I think that we have to take into account just like Rebecca, you posted a thing online the other day asking people for their NFP horror stories and the struggles that they've had. And the response was overwhelming.
It was so overwhelming. I couldn't even use it in a blog post. No.
Like, there were
too much material.
Who had decided to break down and contracept and were being open about it, and they talked about their struggles and how they got to that point. There were people that were in the middle of struggling with it and were trying their hardest to stay, you know, faithful, but were not doing a very good job. We're having a hard time with it, and these are the kind of things that I think have to be, you know, taken into consideration. And that whole concept of development, that whole concept of development of doctrine is, you know, not, you know, I think it's fresh on my mind because of the article that came out the other day about Pope Francis and his statements on the death penalty. And he talked about...
totally relevant.
Yeah, 100%. He talked about the development of doctrine in that. As someone who is a philosophy... a doctorate, right? Don't you have a doctorate in philosophy?
No, never got the doctorate. I got too lazy for that. Master's degree, yeah.
It's better than I have. Yeah. I took a philosophy class in college, and, like, I didn't learn anything from it. But I was a bad student. But as someone, because, Rebecca, you write a lot about philosophy, and you have a much better grasp on that than I do. I want to get your thoughts about that, about the concept of, you know, this developing doctrine. Not just with contraception, but with the death penalty, too, like you talked about, because it is very relevant. It's very connected. If you're not aware, Pope Francis is, I think, the first pope to ever say that the death penalty is not just a bad thing that we should avoid, but is sometimes permissible. But he called it just outright inadmissible. Said it was inhuman and against human dignity. And that is a very much a development on doctrine. Something that I think we're going to see in the next release of the Catechism. Rebecca, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I thought it is interesting because in philosophy we studied many, many years ago Newman and the development of doctrine, and I think that's an important... That and textual criticism are both really important to keep in mind when you look at what Pope Francis is saying in light of what prior popes said, in light of... previous teaching documents, because there is a hermeneutic of continuity there. It may look at times as though the Pope is saying, no, what you said before was wrong and this is right. But I think the error that we're making is we're looking instead of at core values that are revealed to the church, through the church. Instead, we're looking at these specific verbal formulations each step of the way. Mm-hmm. If at the heart of every verbal formulation has to be a fundamental acknowledgement of some truth, that fundamental acknowledgement is what's guiding the unfolding and the understanding, which yields these, you know, what looks like different teachings at different times, but what it actually is a greater and deeper understanding of the truth that was already there, so that, you know, if you look at the history of the church's regard for Judaism, for instance, I can't say that I feel especially warmly about some of the statements in the Council of Florence, which ironically were emailed or messaged to me at one point when one of these rad trad people like wanted to make sure I wasn't practicing any Jewish practices,
keep that
like,
Jewry
devoutly,
out of my
because if so, I was going to be damned. That's right. Yeah, this was delightful. It was actually a former colleague.
Man, good Lord.
So, you know, I look at
that.
You
work with some crazy people.
Yeah, lovely. Thanks. I know. I mean, I worked with some awesome people, too, but there were some others. I wanted to, like, walk around toting a menorah and be like, watch me be Jewish. Yeah. But that's a perfect example where at the heart of our faith is an understanding of a proper relationship with other religions, and especially the Jewish religion, which Jesus himself practiced. And so some of the earlier formulations, got some parts of it right, but were still kind of moving towards a full understanding. And Pope Benedict had this great statement. I just want to put this in huge letters everywhere. And it was Pope Benedict, mind you, who said, we do not possess the truth. We approach it. And he said this to a group of, I think it was young university professors. And I read that and I was like, wow, that's so true. Because if the truth is infinite, there's no way we can possess it. So when we understand that the Catholic Church has the fullness of revealed truth, that doesn't mean that we have a bunch of verbal propositions piled up somewhere, you know, in some kind of a bottle somewhere, because that's not the right way to understand it. The right way to understand it is the presence of Christ, the Logos, and everything that it means for Christ to be one with humanity unfolding. So, yeah, totally the understanding of the death penalty, it can't be like, oh, at one time God said, yeah, it's okay for the state to kill some people. That doesn't even make sense, because the idea of the nation state, as we understand it in our current definitions, wasn't a thing back at the time of the early church. This is a very modern invention. So the idea that the state has the right to kill people sometimes is A, anachronistic, and B, kind of contrary to the fundamental teachings about not killing. So it seems to me that that's always been kind of, I don't know, like an allowance that's made, not a final teaching, but a...
It reminds me of in the New Testament, when Pharisees and Sadducees are trying to, you know, trick Jesus, and they're asking him, you know, is it okay to divorce my wife? Moses said it was okay, and Jesus said, yeah, Moses said it was okay,
right,
because you were all ignorant assholes. But since the beginning, that's not been it. And so, like, I like the word allowance a lot. That. And I think I kind of relate that too to a little bit of something that's always struck out to me, and this is a little bit of a stretch, but just sort of in relating that about there's a, I can't remember which where it is, I'm going to misquote it so terribly, but there's a part in the Gospels where Jesus is asked by his disciples why he speaks in parables, and his answer is basically because these people aren't ready for the truth yet. They're not really ready to understand that.
Right.
And I think that's a thing that you see not just throughout the Bible, but throughout all of Christianity. It's like Pope Benedict said, the truth is something that we approach, and we kind of get it in pieces, or we get allowances at a time. You know, there's plenty of stuff now that people in the olden days would have done, or would have even been sanctioned by the church, that we wouldn't do it now, because now we know better. Now we've learned something. We've developed further. We've gotten deeper into the truth about it. And so, yeah, the same is said for, you know, like you said, the death penalty is very much, I think it's very much an allowance. And for years, from Pope John Paul II up to Francis, you know, the death penalty was viewed in this context of, look, it's, you have the states have the legitimate authority to do this, but they're very clear, even in the latest catechism, very clear that it's only something that's supposed to be used if there's no other option available. That's the church's teaching on killing in general, that this is a bad thing. This is a very bad thing, and killing is not something that you need to do as a human. It destroys your humanity to take the life of another person, whether that person is a bad guy or not. So that's why killing has never been viewed, in the church's view, it's never been viewed in the concept of something that is, context something that is good or even wholesome or even heroic. It's something that if you have to do it, it can be permissible. And that, I think, too many people, way too many people, get wrapped up in this idea of the Crusades and killing for God and justice. And no, that's bullshit. I'm sorry. It just is. And that's what the church, and the church has said, not that, you know, I don't think they said bullshit, but I mean, it's what it is. Essentially what the church, I think, has said is that,
maybe
no,
they should.
I think so. I would, oh God, I would love to Pope Francis just come and go, no, this is bullshit. You can't do that.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
But, it's not good to kill people. If you don't have to kill people, you shouldn't do it. John Paul II said, if that we have the means, that there's really no reason today for us to have to do it. And so when you're, I've always argued that one of my main things against the death penalty has always been that we don't have to do it anymore. We don't have to do it. We can adequately keep people, bad guys who are going to kill, you know, without hesitation. We can keep them away from society. We can protect society from those people without having to kill them. Because even the worst serial killer, even your Jeffrey Dahmers of the world, still possess their right to life.
Mm-hmm.
And they still possess their inherent dignity. You can't get, it is not up to us to decide who does and doesn't deserve the right to life. At the end of the day, it's not up to us. We've been allowed to have that, but I think what Pope Francis is saying, and I think where the development of this doctrine is going, is that we're at a point now, we're civilized enough, we're advanced enough, we don't have to do this, and at this point to do it would just be flat out wrong and inhumane, and I agree, and I wholeheartedly support changing what is in the catechism now to just an outright abolition and an outright opposition to the death penalty. And I personally can't wait to see what kind of fallout comes from that, because it's going to be because it's really interesting to me. I'm really going to be interested by it, because if the Pope comes out and says it is wrong to use, if the Catechism comes out and says the death penalty is wrong, period, then you can't do it, then that's going to put it on the same level as something like abortion. I'm not saying that, you know, that necessarily from a moral perspective that a murderer and an innocent unborn child are the same, but if the church is saying you can't do this thing, then I think a lot of right-wing Catholics are going to have to wrestle with that, because one of their biggest charges for so long has been, oh, those Catholic Democrats still support abortion, churches can't do that. And I think in a lot of ways so far they've had a lot of room to get away with their belief on the death penalty. But if this comes out, I think you're going to see an interesting struggle. And I would also imagine that you're going to suddenly hear a lot of people saying, well, Pope Francis he didn't say it from the chair with his right hand up and a certain hat on, and therefore it doesn't count.
Right.
So I support that development.
Almost nothing has been said that way. Yeah.
Right.
I mean,
go ahead.
If we were talking earlier about making NFP into a sacrament, and, you know, at least NFP is a good thing. I've been sharing all these stories about how all these people are suffering with it, but I've also written about how it's incredibly empowering and can be very wholesome and good. So, you know, if you're making NFP into a sacrament, then that's unfortunate. If you're making the death penalty into a sacrament, though, then, because that's the way I feel that people are sometimes. You know, they're protecting the death penalty as though it were a protection of life, when it's actually the opposite. And to go back to what you said about, you know, comparing that to abortion, I would agree absolutely that an actual, like, mass murderer does not have the same kind of right to life as an innocent unborn child. But A, he does have a right to life, and B, many women who are choosing abortion do so in a situation where they kind of have no other really obvious choice, whereas those who are carrying out capital punishment have other options. So I think that they are, in fact, more culpable, even if the act itself is less materially bad. So, and that's the point I've wanted to make for a while. Just only comes to me when I'm driving,
right,
with a microphone on.
That's a
but Matthew, I wanted to, you know, if we have time, I feel like this question about contraception versus NFP could kind of connect with yet another issue that's been all abuzz on social networking today, and not just among Catholics, and that's the issue of sexual assault. Oh, mm-hmm. And you've been following that one too, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, it's the case. The Hollywood scandal coming out, but it's also mm-hmm. the Me Too campaign that's been going on Facebook and Twitter today, where all of these women and men are mm-hmm. coming out and saying, you know, yes, it happened to me too, that this is how prevalent it is. Mm-hmm. And, okay, so how does this connect with NFP? Well, it connects because I've spoken with a number of people for whom the prospect of pregnancy is terrifying because they're suffering from trauma after mm-hmm. rape. And no, this is not to say that, you know, everyone needs to run around and using contraception because we're getting assaulted all the time, but I think that we need to be aware. I was just rereading Humanae Vitae, and it talks about the loving relationship between spouses. Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about, and that's what we've been talking about hitherto, pretty much, is mm-hmm. couples who are trying to work out a good marriage together. But now we're being reminded of all the sexual activity that's not loving spouses, nor is it even just goofy people having fun together or people using each other for pleasure, which obviously mm-hmm. the church is opposed to. It's acts of violence mm-hmm. against people, sex as an act of violence. So with that on the table, I feel like we just need to consider the extent to which sex is happening without any unitive function at all.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that? Like that, I mean, am I making kind of a leap here, putting these two together, or should I maybe be thinking about sexual assault just more on its own?
No, I don't think so. I think that it ties in, and I think that, I think that there's millions and millions of people in the world, and there's more than I know of women in the world who are dealing with this issue. And I think that it needs to be considered. I think it sort of plays more into this broader concept that we've been talking about over the last two episodes. You know, we talked last time a lot about how there's so much gray, how there's so much gray area, and how everything's just a big mush of gray.
Mm, yeah.
And I think that there's a lot of intersecting points that we don't consider. And for every and I think that's just another one. Women who the idea of pregnancy could be emotionally, physically, mentally damaging beyond repair after sexual assault is one thing. Mm-hmm. Or women who might be in some sort of relationship where we're getting pregnant with, maybe it's an abusive relationship, a very complicated, complex, abusive relationship, and for complicated and complex reasons, she hasn't, you know, left yet or hasn't gotten out yet, or there's just more to it. It's just not as easy for her to escape. And, you know, these are all issues in which this, you know, like you said, this teaching about contraception, I think, has to be considered. So yeah, I think all these things need to be considered in this context, and there's a lot more to it, and I'm sure we'll get more into it as we move along with the show. But I think that, unfortunately, that's going to be it for us tonight. So thank you for tuning in, as always, and another reminder: don't forget to subscribe if you haven't subscribed yet. Please do. $9.99 a month. If you can afford it, you get all this great content. Plus, you get lots of cool discounts. And as a matter of fact, keep promising swag. As a matter of fact, my wife is making some decals as we speak. And Rebecca, if I'm not mistaken, you are going to a conference this weekend where some of those decals are going to be on display, right?
I am.
So if you're in
the Life Peace Justice Conference, and all the cool, consistent life ethic people will be there. It's in Pittsburgh, so if you're in the Pittsburgh area, come hang out.
Well, I can't go because I live in BFE, Alabama, and
I know.
but anyways, but yeah, and so signing up to be that member, you're going to start getting some cool decals and swags and stuff from us too. So please do it, and because it's going to help us out, help us go a long way. So thank you guys as always for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you so much. Skip.